You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby. CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Underrepresented music, local voices, and real people. You keep CJSF independent.
You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show. We're continuing our look at the book, The Mind of the CEO, which looks at the future of the corporation by Jeffrey E. Garton. Last show, we were looking at the chapter, A Broader Agenda. The author of the book emphasizes that CEOs should never become slaves to their own organization. I recall what happened on the U.S. trade mission to China in 1995. As part of this trip, Secretary Ron Brown led some 20 chief executives to meet various ministers in Beijing to try and close a variety of pending deals in which U.S. companies were involved. During a few hours break, Brown asked the CEOs to join him for coffee in a small hotel conference room. Jackets were removed, ties loosened. Brown asked the leaders whether there couldn't be some breakthrough on business attitudes towards human rights. Why, he wondered aloud, was it so difficult to get major U.S. companies to agree to a general code of conduct that would cover their entire worldwide operations? Surely, no one there was against improving human rights, he said. And if all of the companies were here signed up, no one would be competitively disadvantaged. After some back and forth as to what would be in the code, one CEO said, well, I don't see any big problems here. Others nodded their agreement. After some more discussions, Brown asked if this group of business leaders could sign on to a code as soon as they returned to Washington. Everyone agreed. Unfortunately, it never happened. Although Brown sent around a draft code within a week, it found its way to various legal departments and trade associations. In short order, virtually all the CEOs had backed away, quote, on advice of staff and counsel. We ended up with nothing. Business executives could do more to forge better understandings with labor leaders. Union membership in the United States is a pale shadow of what it was in the 1950s and 1960s, and the role of labor unions in Europe and Japan has weakened considerably. But it would be a mistake to assume that workers do not have legitimate problems that globalization intensifies. Lacking alternatives, they will find ways to form organized resistance to change, especially when the current period of prosperity ends. An analysis by Aaron Bernstein in Business Week in August 2000 underscored this point. Quote, the best economy in 30 years has brought a bounty of jobs and exuberant spending, but last year, 43% of workers at large corporations find it very difficult to balance their work and personal responsibilities, according to Chicago's International Survey Research. 44% said they are very much underpaid for what they do. An astonishing 40 million employees say they would vote to join a union today if given the chance. The issue isn't just a defensive one, however. The new economy is foremost about people, and it's about creating an environment in which they can be productive and able to take advantage of changing opportunities. How much time do CEOs spend trying to form alliances with labor organizations rather than opposing them? How much do they think about innovative ways to jointly lower healthcare costs while improving care, or to create joint training programs, or programs that will help dual wage earners with daycare, parental support, stress reduction, and the like? How many high-level discussions have occurred concerning the foregoing giving of a new economy agenda, including provision of lifetime learning opportunities and the portable benefits that highly mobile workforces now need? John Brown, Mark Moody Stewart, William Ford, and others have made progress in the environmental arena, articulating specific goals, discussing them with NGOs and governments, and allowing third-party audits of the results. But businesses, governments, and international institutions and NGOs are just learning how to communicate with one another. For the most part, cooperation is at best tentative on the environment, labor, human rights, genetically modified products, and economic development in the poorer countries. Nevertheless, certain companies are exploring new approaches which others should emulate. For a good deal of the year 2000, before the Firestone tire recall, William Ford and his team met on several occasions with some of their harshest environmental critics. Similar efforts have been made by BP and Royal Dutch Shell. In addition to trying to understand one another's goals and constraints, the benefit of these meetings is in the establishment of an air of openness. This kind of atmosphere becomes invaluable when a crisis hits. And William Ford told the Wall Street Journal that the activists he's been meeting with don't expect us to be perfect. They expect to be open and honest and compromise. Under these circumstances, companies have a much better chance to get the benefit of the doubt as they work through various problems. One example of a promising effort is the Fair Labor Association, also known as the FLA, a group formed by 11 leading apparel companies, including Nike, Patagonia, Liz Claiborne, by NGOs like Lawyers Committee for Human Rights, and the National Consumers League, and by 141 universities. With encouragement from the U.S. government, the FLA is working to eliminate fresh sweatshops around the world. Members have developed a code that prohibits forced labor and child labor and supports freedom of association, minimum wages, maximum working hours, clean bathrooms, and similar rights and amenities. The group has begun to monitor one another's facilities abroad to conduct surprise inspections. To inform consumers, companies, and compliance with the code can put FLA labels on all of their products. Though more such inspections are needed and more public transparency regarding the results, the FLA does reflect the understanding that consumers care about and the conditions under which a product is made. Other industries should emulate these practices, using the FLA model for how businesses, enlightened social activists, and governments can work together. Another example is simply called Global Compact, organized by the UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, signed in July 2000 by Nike, Daimler Chrysler, Royal Dutch, and dozens of other global companies, together with 12 labor associations and public interest groups, and aimed at improving human rights, eliminating child labor, and protecting the environment. In one way, it is a rhetorical document, since there are no sanctions for violations. However, companies have committed themselves to important first steps such as posting on their websites progress made in implementing the principles and agreeing to a series of meetings to explore ways to promote Compact's goals. The Compact came after an accord signed a few months before in Paris by the 20 organizations of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development regarding how corporations should act to safeguard basic environmental and labor standards. The accord recognizes that many of the big, contentious economic and social issues can be handled only with global companies in the lead. The upshot is that CEOs need to get in front of movements they see coming, rather than always fighting a rearguard action. It has taken a while, but a number of companies have moved in this direction when it comes to environmental protection. BP, Ford, Daimler Chrysler, IBM, Royal Dutch Shell, Johnson & Johnson have all pledged to make big cuts in greenhouse gas emissions in advance of any law or treaty obligations. Several of them are joining with the Environmental Defense Fund, an NGO, to develop specific plans for implementation and measurement of performance. But there are counterexamples as well. Consider the pharmaceutical industry, which has recently succumbed to pressure to contribute subsidized medicines to combat AIDS throughout Africa. It is inconceivable that these companies, with their international reach, were not aware that these diseases were spinning out of control in poor countries. Yet they waited until governments and the UN highlighted the crisis and pointed to both the availability and high cost of certain drugs. Admittedly, from the corporate standpoint, there had been some logic in holding back until public problems were adequately defined and a course of action was made clear and supported by governments involved. But the inevitable result was that companies are seen as doing too little, too late, and then as merely waging a public relations campaign. An alternative would have been for a group of CEOs representing the leading pharmaceutical companies to have worked together to have taken an early lead in defining a solution that would have entailed private-public partnerships. This might have included specific roles not just for the companies, but for national governments and international institutions. It would have been a real demonstration of business leadership of the kind it's hard to discern today. Economic development in one area in business can do much more alone and in partnership with other sectors. James Wolfenson advanced specific ideas for what corporations can do to tackle some of the most serious problems in the world, and by implication, what they themselves face. Quote, "I think there is no doubt that big business has to think more in terms of social and economic policy than they have," he told me. "One reason is that there are fewer of them because so many mergers, and they're becoming greater concentrations of power in the private sector. The relative importance is becoming significantly greater as a creator of jobs, conveyor of knowledge, and source of innovation. But too few industrial leaders think out of the box in terms of their perception of their broader responsibilities to society." Here are some of the things that Wolfson's son would like to see business do. Quote, "First and foremost is the issue of contribution to the social context, the social structure, workers' rights, human rights, conditions of employment," he said. "Secondly, health, education, and welfare of all their employees. Third, community involvement, sharing leadership in the community." A lot of these business establishments are closed at night, but they have computers, they have bright young people, and they could help the community with training. They could work in helping young entrepreneurs, and generally they could interface with governments in an effective way to create an environment in which private investment flows. Among the most innovative corporate attempts to make a contribution to global advancement is a recent partnership between Cisco Systems and the United Nations Development Program, also known as UNDP, focused on using the internet to alleviate poverty in the developing world. Cisco is taking responsibility for creating and maintaining a website that allows people and organizations everywhere to better understand the nature of poverty, to get personally involved in specific programs, and to match up their own capabilities with specific needs in poor countries. On the website, a donor will be able to identify a problem in the third world and make a contribution to its resolution, and then track the impact of the commitment. UNDP is the on-the-ground agent in over 100 countries. The partnership, which is called NetAid.org, plans to involve other corporations. This is an experiment, to be sure, but the combination of corporations, public entities, and the use of new information technology holds great promise. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you're listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenary. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
In Pakistan, a woman is murdered for trying to get out of an abusive marriage. A 16-year-old girl is raped, and because she's been raped, she's then shot for dishonoring her community. In many countries, domestic and community violence against women is commonplace. Women are harassed, tortured, and killed, often in the name of local custom, while the police and judges and other government officials turn their backs. But international law says that governments are obliged to protect the human rights of women, not turn their backs when women are attacked. Make sure governments live up to their obligations. Speak out today. Human rights violations against women can be stopped. Call 1-800-AMNESTY or check out our website at www.amnesty.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenary, professional futurist.
Welcome back. We are looking at the book, The Mind of the CEO, by Jeffrey E. Garton, which looks at the future of the corporation and how corporations are evolving. Last we were looking at the chapter, A Broader Agenda. Next section. Then there is a need for rules for cyberspace. The newness of the technology and the number of emerging public policy questions make this area both difficult and important for CEOs to address. Stephen Case is the only CEO I interviewed who underscored the unresolved regulatory problems with the internet has revealed. In so doing, he expressed the concern that business leaders will take too narrow a view of what they should do. Quote, I think that the biggest risk is that we are at a unique point of time when the internet is big enough to matter, but still young enough and small enough to be shaped, he said. So it is important that business leaders take a step back and don't just focus on building their own services and their own companies, but also focus on building a medium we could be proud of. Otherwise, there is a real possibility that it could go wrong. It's going to require a sustained commitment and a genuine dialogue between business and government and consumer groups to make sure that it's all done right. There's a growing need for the Silicon Valley culture to recognize that it is winning. It is having the kind of impact on people's lives it always wanted to have. However, but with this success comes great responsibility. Case has been relentless in pursuing the communications industry to evolve itself in a host of public policies which will affect it. In an extensive series of public pronouncements, and also in his interview with me, he's not only enumerated many of the issues, but suggested an internet model of addressing them, one based on extensive partnerships between industry, government, and consumers. The goal of building a framework for internet self-governance is no doubt ambitious, particularly in an industry of such diversity and dynamicism. Certainly, the internet is like no other medium. It has no center, it has no edges. Its stakeholders include not only a wide variety of businesses, but also advocacy and public interest groups, and of course, consumers. And so self-governance of the internet will be something different, something that reflects the unique nature of the medium, as well as the unique characteristics of our internet community. AOL's chief executive prescribes that many partners in this endeavor and prescribes what they should do. Governments must preserve an open playing field, revamp its outdated telecommunications regulatory process, and help see to it that everyone has access to the internet. Industry has an obligation to ensure that consumers can trust the information they get through cyberspace and that privacy is protected. And it must enlist the help of nonprofit organizations to address educational needs. Industry needs at least to help bridge the technical gap that divides people. Consumers, for their part, need to get more involved in understanding the medium, making their views known as parents and as citizens. Case talks about the need for extensive partnerships and alliances among groups that have rarely talked to each other in order to get a handle on changes in the world that the internet will force, from taxation to censorship. This new paradigm of communications will enable people, already it has enabled people, to talk to those otherwise they wouldn't talk to, and engage them on issues they might otherwise not engage in. The internet is largely the force that is blowing up traditional walls that separate industries and countries. Just how far can the internet self-regulation go, and how much government involvement will be required? An enlightened position for CEOs would like to be to accept significant dose of both. In a period of enormous change, the government would be foolish to overprescribe and stifle innovation. Yet companies cannot be the sole arbiters of public interest. Collective decisions must be made, not just by industry, but by a wide range of other constituencies. And that can only happen through the formal institutions of democratic governments. CEOs should be working closely with governments to anticipate where new laws and regulations will be required. For example, I do not believe commerce on the internet should not escape taxation, since fees are levied on all other types of commerce. Aside from the sheer unfairness of this lopsided arrangement, too much tax revenue essential to the functioning of the economies would be lost. The questions ought to be, what kind of tax system could work? And how could cyber taxes relate to the various systems now in place? Privacy is another matter that cannot be left to industry. In all cases, future solutions will have to be global in scope, matching the reach of the internet. Now is the time for global CEOs to join forces to help sketch out what these international regimes will look at. Global CEOs also ought to play a more effective role in influencing top government leaders at the annual heads of state summits and in the various ministerial meetings of the IMF and WTO. Today they appear on the fringes of these events as hangers-on. There's no clear, concerted business voice. A major business summit in advance in which CEOs project their collective views of the world and their agenda would get considerable attention, provided that it isn't just a business agenda, but is a broader picture of how to promote globalization. It could have even more impact than the government meetings with their stale communiques and vacuous sound bites. Top corporate executives ought to be presenting their views about the agenda in a way that gives governments and the private something to react to. We would benefit by knowing what CEOs think about where the IMF and World Trade Organization and World Bank would be headed. The last time there was fresh thinking about the landscape of global economic institutions in its entirety was half a century ago in the aftermath of World War II. With the end of the Cold War and the advent of the Internet, the rise of big emerging markets in the world economy, the intensifying globalization of trade, finance, and foreign investment, and the explosion of critical issues relating to the environment, why don't CEOs call for another round of thinking similar to the 1944 Bretton Woods Conference? It would be less effective if they conducted a conference on their own, for government leaders are essential. So are CEOs, though, and nothing is stopping them from trying to get such an event launched. The range of business challenges faced by modern CEOs makes a broader leadership role in society problematic, to be sure. But if we conclude that more business involvement at the top is essential, then the model of what today's CEO is and does needs to be modified. At least two changes could be made. First, it is difficult to envision global companies being efficiently run by one person who is chairman, CEO, and sometimes president as well. Together, the burden of all these responsibilities is too great not to be shared. No one formula will fit all companies, but someone at the top, preferably the chairman, needs to have its major responsibility in the kinds of broader social issues that we've discussed here in this work. There are, in principle, many options, each of which needs to fit a particular situation to cultivate any specific firm. Frederick Smith points to his own model at FedEx, which consists of an office of the chairman, a team that includes himself and several others. Quote, "We have a small group of very capable and sophisticated officers in the chief executive unit," he said. "It is a five-person executive committee which oversees the operations of our companies, including the complexities of the global environment, a demanding Wall Street, and the press, in addition to me, of course. It includes the chief financial officer, the chief information officer, the head of marketing and communications, and the general counsel. We didn't invent this system, but I believe it is catching on in many companies." In late 2000, the pressures on the Ford Motor Company showed that running big multinational companies may be too much for one person. And this fact is something that we're going to be investigating in future shows. So please stay tuned, and thank you for your attention.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby, and Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Teneri, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.
Listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
This is Bird Note. Walk into the visitor center at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, and you'll be greeted by the wall of birds. The massive mural shows a map of the world.
And on this map, you're going to see painted in life size all the modern families of birds. And then when you walk up a stairwell, you're going to be greeted with a parade of extinct animals that belong to the evolutionary history of birds.
That's artist Jane Kim, who partnered with the Cornell Lab to create 270 life-sized portraits, ranging from the